with Caribou. Stay tuned for the Indigenous Power Hour mix here on KBOO Portland.
This program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio is available online at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
If you stop to listen, hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
They're hello everyone, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, missing and murdered indigenous women and girls in the Coastal Pomo Nation in Northern California, and an update on the escalation of state military cartel violence in Chiapas, Mexico. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone fool in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bar.
In the first segment of our program today here on American Indian Airwaves, we go to the Coastal Pomo Nation in Northern California, where this past May of 2023 was the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls and Two-Spirited Peoples. Marcus Lopez, executive producer and host of American Indian Airwaves, and myself have the honor and pleasure to speak with Bernadette Antoinette Smith of the Coastal Pomo Nation. She is a cultural resource specialist and a board member for the Hakekodile organization, an indigenous women's-led organization. She's an environmental social justice activist as well as a language cultural revivalist. And now, Marcus Lopez and myself speaking with Bernadette Antoinette Smith on murdered indigenous women in the Coastal Pomo Nation in Northern California.
When I was up in the Red Dress Day, the raising awareness and missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, and two-spirited people event program up in Laguna Grande Ballroom on Oldermeyer Center up in Seaside, California, I was impressed and honored to meet so many women that talk about what they say, no more Soul Sisters, missing and murdered Indigenous women. It was a powerful panel discussion. Within that discussion, I witnessed Bernadette Antoinette Smith, who gave a powerful presentation on her panel discussion. We have now, I want to welcome Bernadette Antoinette Smith on our program here on the American Indian Airways.
Shamai, he'en maya iwak to shishima imta Bernadette Smith, and I come from the Manchester Band of Pomo Indians up in Northern California. I am Coastal Pomo, and it's an honor to be here today with you. Thank you. Yahui.
Now, Bernadette, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, the area you're from, because you're talking to people in the internet and then in turn within Southern California. Where are you? Describe that for our listeners.
Yeah, so I come from the Mendocino Coast, and that's up north, I'd say about 4 hours south of Eureka. Yeah, so I come from the Redwood Forest area. We are ocean people. We live in a small rancheria, they call it, up in Northern California. It's about 300 people or so living on the reservation. And yeah, it's a rural area, but we are definitely rich in culture and tradition. We have our spiritual dances and songs that still live on today. And yeah, we're very proud people of that.
You have a very interesting history, I know that, in Northern California. And there are many indigenous nations up there. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the Red Dress Day? What is the, you're raising awareness, and that's why we're talking with you, mm-hmm. about missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Give us an overview for our listeners about that.
Yeah, so the Red Dress Day is to kind was brought out to highlight our missing and murdered Indigenous women and give us a day to kind of honor them and raise awareness and recognize our sisters who have been lost or stolen. So part of that being said, my part in that Red Dress Day was particular to me having my sister, Nicole Smith, who had been murdered in 2017. So since then, I've been involved with the MMIW strongly. I'm kind of leaning on that day of awareness, and not just that day, but all days, being able to connect with other families and kind of share stories and give strength to each other, and also to let the public and non-Native allies know what they can do and how they can help and what we need them to help us with.
Thank you. Now, we know that on Red Dress Day, talk about raising awareness. I was very honored to be there, number one. But second of all, the powerful Native women and community that showed up, Indigenous community that showed up on that day. It was a two-day event. It was totally powerful. But also within that, and that's why we want to interview you, Bernadette, in order to raise awareness around the social justice community. There seems to be that room, in my opinion, should have been packed because it's such an important issue to Indigenous people across the board. Now, with that, and you mentioned it, tell us about the event leading to your sister Nicole Smith being murdered. Give us some background on that, please.
Yes, of course. So my sister Nicole Smith was murdered in November of 2017. I'll give you a little background about what happened that night. So the day started like any normal day. It was, you know, coming to be Christmas time next month, so we were putting up Christmas decorations, we were listening to Christmas music, and as it came to the evening time, I had a lot of my little cousins spending the night because everybody liked to come to Auntie Burns' house, you know, and hang out, and it was just a fun place to be. So, you know, I had all my little cousins over, and my best friend's daughter was there, and my nieces were there. And, of course, my sister Nicole was there. And, you know, so everybody's having a good time. Everybody went to bed. And about 4:30 in the morning, I heard a really loud thump. It sounded like maybe a car hit my house on the rancheria. And I woke up, and I seen a lot of the kids were screaming, and everybody was running around. And my sister's boyfriend said, you know, everybody get down, they're shooting the house up, somebody shooting the house, and I was kind of just waking up from sleeping, and I was being, you know, bombarded with all this commotion. And so we put the kids on the floor, and, you know, I was doing a head count, seeing where everybody was. I then realized one of my nieces, who was 15 at the time, her name's Star Brightman, granddaughter of Professor Lehman Brightman, a very well-known professor throughout Native country. She had also been shot. She was 15 years old at the time. We kind of were tending to her, and I went to see why my sister hadn't came out of the room yet, and she was laying on the floor. And so that's kind of what happened there. We discovered that she wasn't breathing, called 911. Sister's boyfriend ended up taking the kids. We ran them across the street to my parents' house, who lived about three houses away from my house on the Rancheria. So we took the kids there, and I stayed back with my sister, and we waited for what seemed like over an hour, maybe even longer than that, for help to come to the Rancheria. Yeah. And when they finally did arrive, they had my niece Star, who had been shot, walk off the Rancheria down the road on, this is like mountainous roads, to get into the ambulance for safety way far away. So that was kind of one of our issues we had with them, was making my niece, who had been shot, who was scared, who was frightened, who was a minor, walk from the home off the Rancheria down the road. You know, it was kind of one of those things where we didn't understand why they did that, department, and why they took so long to send an ambulance. But those are just some of those things that happen when we live in these rural areas where most of the rancherias in Northern California are.
What about Nicole?
Nicole was a mother of three. She was a sister. She was a daughter. She was a beautiful traditional dancer. She was very talented. She was a preschool teacher at the Native American preschool in Pinoleville, California. She was loved by a lot of the children, you know, members of the Native community. She really had a big role in the lives of the Native children, teaching them language, teaching them song, traditional song. She really left a lasting impact on those children, who many of them came to her funeral and talked on her behalf, little children, you know, because that's how much of a beautiful person and an impactful person she was in our community.
Now, when the ambulance took so long, what was the outcome? It was past the point of no return, or talk about that for us.
Yeah. So as we were waiting for the ambulance, I did call back several times to 911, and I asked them, you know, what's taking so long? Should I just put my sister in the car? Because she's like fading away. And they told me, they advised me not to move her, to leave her there. And we noticed, me and my niece, who had been shot, were waiting there for help, and she wasn't breathing anymore. We couldn't identify any wounds. They used what they call a birdshot shotgun. So it had lots of little bullets. So I guess she had some. Later on, we found out they had entered her body at different areas that eventually had caused her death. But so there was no physical things that we can see, like big shots or nothing, no bleeding, nothing like that. So it was kind of, in a way, it was not as maybe traumatizing as it could have been if there was something like that. She looked very peaceful. So, yeah, we were able to just wait with her, and we knew she had already been gone. So, you know, we do have traditional things that we do when somebody passes. So we definitely turn to those things in that moment. We grabbed our traditional medicine, some angelica root. We grabbed a traditional instrument we use to pray with, which is a clapper. Mm-hmm. We call it a clapstick, and sang some traveling songs for her, not just for her, but for our own comfort in that time, because we were pretty scared. So by the time the ambulance got there, she had already been gone. And, you know, one strange thing was, because it was a crime scene, you know, they left my sister's body in there for about 2 days. As the family waited outside, we all gathered around outside the house. Her children sat on the yellow crime scene tape right past it, you know, on the floor, for a whole day and a half, you know, waiting for their mom to come out. As so did my dad, my mom, our whole family. We had about 40 people waiting outside. And they finally brought my sister's body out when we told them the importance that we needed to do some ceremony for her. And we were lucky that the mortuary people who were picking her up brought her body right to the street. And we were able to sing for her right there and kind of bless her way as she traveled beyond, you know, her body to where she was going next. And it was a beautiful thing to be able to do that, but it was also one of the saddest moments of my life to see my sister's body wheeled out on a gurney from, you know, the crime scene.
Bernadette, talk about, now you said the body was there for a day and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about the law enforcement? What was their part in all of this?
So, as far as law enforcement, in Point Arena, California, we don't have any on-site people. We use the sheriff's department with deputies, you know, throughout all of Mendocino County. So, I think they say there's about 7 deputies that work the whole county, which is a pretty big county. So, their reasoning for not getting there very fast was, you know, they came from our.
No, you don't have any. Yeah. You don't, Bernadette, you don't have any tribal police or anything like that, do you?
No, our tribe is very small in comparison to other tribes, and our capacity, no, we don't have anything like that.
And so, how, like Bernadette, how long did they take to get there?
Well, it took over an hour. I know where they were coming from. They said they were coming from a place called Fort Bragg, which is about 45 minutes. But because of the manner of the crime, they needed to wait. This is what they told us. You know, this was their reasoning with us, was that they needed to wait for backup for that one officer. So then we had to potentially wait for another one to come from a whole different area before either one could come into the scene to help.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Bernadette Antoinette Smith, a cultural resource specialist, activist, and more from the Coastal Pomo Nation. She's speaking on murdered Indigenous women in the Coastal Pomo Nation in Northern California. And now back to the interview.
So that's what happened there. But of course, once they came in and once the sheriffs came, you know, they came in and seen my sister. They called the ambulance, and then they determined that she had already been gone, and they just shut it down as a crime scene and then basically brought in other investigators that weren't the sheriff's department anymore. They were, you know, the investigation team. And they stayed there for 2 days and going in and out and, you know, doing all this measuring and all this stuff. And we were like, okay, something's going to happen. You know, something, that they're really taking their time here and, you know, taking all this time. It felt like days, you know, and nothing came of it. Nothing came of any of it. You know, there was footprints on the door where they tried to kick in. There was a handprint where they slid the door open or the window open where my sister was killed in that room. There were shotgun shells on the floor. You know, there was a phone that I used to call the police next to my sister. They took everybody's phone, but somehow left that phone right there in the room. You know, I there were certain things that I didn't understand of how they did their investigation, you know, but I'm not knowledgeable on that, so I can't say really they did something right or wrong, but there was a couple things that it just didn't seem like they were thorough in what they were doing.
After the investigation and the detectives or the sheriff department reviewed everything, what came about this incident? What happened afterwards, if anything?
Yeah, so there was a few times when, you know, they interviewed me, they went through my phone, they went, you know, asked me who was I associating with recently in the past, or could there have been any, you know, people who wanted to see harm done to us. And, you know, we're like going through our own minds of like, okay, what could it be? What could it be? So we're giving them all this information. They did arrest one guy who we suspected was involved later to just release him, you know, because they didn't have enough evidence to keep him. And so what ended up happening was absolutely nothing. And the case went cold. We were calling them often with leads that we were getting from community members talking and letting us know that they heard this or heard that, and, you know, fingers are being pointed. And we let them know these tips. And the sheriff's department told me that not to call them anymore. They don't want any more information, that every time we tell them something, it's just wasting their time because it's leading nowhere. So I told my mom right there with the sheriff on the phone, because my mom was kept telling me, call the sheriff and tell him this, call him and tell him that, every time we would hear something. So I was doing it, and I told my mom, Mom, listen to this. This man does not want us to call him anymore. He does not want us to give any more tips. He's saying that's it. They're done with this. They don't want nothing more from us. And, you know, he's like, I need to talk to your mom. Let me talk to your mom. And he tried to, like, apologize to her. But it's what he said. He told us we're wasting his time. And for nothing to ever come of it. You know, they never had any answers. They never figured anything out. They've never solved the case. At my sister's funeral, the police were harassing me so much, telling me that I knew something, that I could make this whole case close if I just talked to them and told them this one piece of information that they thought I was withholding. They came to my sister's funeral and had me leave my sister's funeral to do an interview with them. I did. They picked me up from there. I went there to the sheriff's department's office, gave them this whole interview again, and nothing came of it. You know, so what they thought was so important, that I needed to leave my own sister's funeral to come and interview with them, they still didn't even do nothing, absolutely nothing. And that's the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department.
What about the FBI? Was there any other either state or federal agencies that were apprised of the murder? And if so, what has been the outcome?
Yeah, so there has been no resources through the FBI. We have some kind of agreement where the sheriff's department is in our jurisdictional area. So we don't really have access to that, even though we are on federal land. We use the California Sheriff's Department. So there wasn't anything done with that.
Bernadette, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I was wondering if you can give our listeners a sense of what home is in relationship to who you think might be the perpetrators. And so oftentimes, you know, when we think of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and LGBTQAI plus peoples, you know, we think of, say, the man camps, for example, the history of the logging industry, the extractive industries, KOA camps on the East Coast that are, you know, can be hubs for trafficking. And I was wondering, for back home there in the Coastal Pomo Nation, give our listeners a sense of what home is like in relationship to the murder of Indigenous women.
Yeah, so unlike other situations where we hear about man camps and things like that, here in Northern California, especially here in Mendocino County, it seems that lateral violence has been the factor here. Native on native crime happening here. A lot of that related to drug use, to alcoholism, homelessness, you know, broken homes. So it's definitely a case that I've seen more recently of lateral violence throughout our people here in Mendocino County. And that's kind of the narrative that has been happening for the last few years, is drug use happening, bad company, domestic violence, kidnappings from other Native people on other Native people. So it's not really coming from the outside of our community as much as it's within our own community. And that's where the unsettling, unsafe feeling comes in, when you feel like you can't depend or trust or feel safe within your community. And our communities aren't very large, you know, so.
Bernadette, that's why we wanted to have this interview with you, because it's not it's a very touching scenario, yeah. You know, a murder of a Native woman. especially Nicole, your sister. And you made it perfectly clear within the panel discussion that it needs to be resolved, you know, that, and because of the fact that 178 public law and all the reservations, you know, the sheriff or the police department are involved in the jurisdiction when something like this happens, you know, and whatnot, more than that. But you said that after this, all the investigation, and I wanted to get to this because you spoke about it, about it's a cold case, so-called, but it's not cold to you. It's very alive. Talk about that, about ways and means in which, not critical of the sheriff department, but how the sheriff department, did they do their due diligence from your point of view, from the community's point of view? And then what is you saying this uneasy situation within the community about lateral violence? It goes on to a lot of communities, unfortunately. But yet, talk about that to our listeners, about this notion of security, this notion of this, how you bring into light, you know, this notion of it's not a cold case, you want to reopen it. Are you going through the mechanisms in order to do that? And if so, do you have legal support? Talk about that for us, please.
Yeah, so one of the ways that we put pressure on the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department is by these days of awareness, by amplifying our voices, by letting them hear this within the public community as well, like being invited to talk on the radio. You know, we share these things online and hope that they get back to them. There's been issues. They've been pressured by, I want to mention one girl from Coblo, California. Her name's Khadijah Britton. She is a missing young Native woman from Coblo, California. She went missing about 5 months after my sister's murder. And the sheriff's department there is from same county, Mendocino County Sheriff's, and they haven't, you know, solved anything for her. One thing that her family was able to do, well, I want to say it was support within their tribal leadership that helped push the Mendocino County Sheriff's to tell us what they did. They did a public, they spoke publicly about how many cars they searched, how many people they interviewed, how many hours they spent doing this, searching, things like that. That seemed to be a real comfort to the community. That seemed to ease a little bit of the doubt that our Native community had in the Sheriff's Department, with giving us some real numbers, some answers, some record of their due diligence, some record of the time they spent and the work they put in to try to solve this case. That is something that I would say would be very comforting for our family to have heard. And one thing, I spoke with the Mendocino County Sheriff's on that same day of awareness, one day before I went to Monterey. The Mendocino County Sheriff's deputies were there at that MMIW gathering in Ukiah, California, and I asked him specifically, like, what is it that you guys need? What is it that we can help you guys with? That what is it that you guys need so that you can service our people in this way? And they continuously say they're under-resourced. They need money. They need more money. And so I'm just wondering, you know, how we are able to get that to them, and how do we know that's what they're... So I know the next step after the feather alert system has been implemented, what we want to do is ask for money to be sent to specific sheriff's departments and specific for missing and murdered Indigenous women cases. So that's something I think could remedy that. As far as lateral violence within the community, we have to address that as a community, as a Native community. We need to have more programs addressing addiction, addressing alcoholism and domestic violence. These are all things that lead to these types of cases that I've seen. You know, this is just from my personal experience, but from what I've seen is that these things are the leading cause of our missing and murdered Indigenous women in Mendocino County. And it's up to community and tribal leadership to kind of take the reins on that and to guide us into the direction that we need to go. And I'm a cultural person. I practice traditional dancing and, you know, singing. And for me, that's kept me grounded. It's kept me on a good path. And I know that's what the Creator has sent out and left for us to do. If we just help our people kind of get back into that. You know, we have a few traditionalists, but we need more. We need all our community to kind of gather around that and really honor what the Creator has left for us to keep our community safe. You know, we don't have room for alcoholism and drug use in our ceremonies, and everybody knows that. And we need to make sure, you know, starting kids from a young age, that they respect the ceremony and stay in that good way. And I really think that's the only way we can prevent the lateral violence from happening, you know, just within our own community. And that's kind of where our problem, that's where our issues have been stemming from. And that's, like I said, leaves a feeling of unsafe community within your people, because you don't know who to trust. It could be your own relative.
Bernadette, I couldn't agree with you more, because when people talk about, especially the social justice community, just doesn't get it, about murder and missing Indigenous women, girls, and two-spirited people, it's a real issue. It's a no-nonsense issue. It's not a slogan issue. It's an issue that's affecting our community, and you talk about that lateral violence. I know you're addressing the question within your community. You're a leader within your community. What is your message to, and I was glad that I was involved within that two-day Red Dress Day, because a lot of men, it's a men's issue too. It's not just a women's issue. Mm-hmm. It's all our communities, you know, young and old, all genders, all, you know, all two-spirited people need to realize, and especially the social justice community, need to realize for Indigenous people, this is front and center. What is your comment to the men and women out there, Indigenous men and women, to the girls out there and the boys in our community?
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Bernadette Antoinette Smith, a cultural resource specialist, activist, and more from the Coastal Pomo Nation. She's speaking on murdered Indigenous women in the Coastal Pomo Nation in Northern California. And now back to the interview.
Well, I've been hearing a lot of people talk about what needs to be done and change. And I have to agree with the consensus here is, if you see something, say something. The silence that goes along with being in a Native community and not telling, because we're such a small group of people, especially from reservation to reservation, where you don't want to say something. You don't want to tell, because that's your relative. We're all related. The silence is the killer within itself. The silence is painful for the families who aren't getting answers, not knowing. So I would say that break the silence. You know, if you see something, say something. You know, that's commendable. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's something, it's an honor to be the healing to a family with your words. If you know something and you can share that and heal these people, that's an honor. That's something that we would honor in our community. Not something to be ashamed of, not something to hide behind. So if you know something, say something, speak up. The silence needs to stop.
Thank you, Bernadette. An important message. That being said, how can people help you now?
So people can help me now is by sharing Justice for Nicole Smith. You can find more information about her. She has a $20,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest. You can call to the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department. If you look up Bernadette Antoinette Smith on Facebook, you can find a lot of information about Nicole Smith there, and you'll be able to share her picture with the hashtag Justice for Nicole, and kind of just, like I said, you know, getting her name out there and not letting her be forgotten. Always saying her name and not letting her name be forgotten, her memory. Show up to those MMIW days, you know, when there's call for action, be there. Wear red, you know, but share online on your social medias.
And that was Bernadette Antoinette Smith. here on American Indian Airwaves, speaking on murdered indigenous women in the coastal Pomo Nation in Northern California. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
I walk by a room every day and cry a prayer. I still light the candles, hoping she'll find her way. When I've searched the world, I will find you soon. Just know that I will never give up on you. Somebody took away Khadisha. Stop this screaming, my life is unclear. I still hear her voice, and her laughter is so clear. I pray she is safe, I pray she is near.
The song Khadija by Tracy Lee Nelson here on American Indian Airwaves. In the final segment of our program, we speak with Richard Stoller Schulk, a retired professor emeritus in political science at Eastern Michigan University and a community activist involved with the School of Chiapas. He provides us an update on the state military cartel violence that has escalated over the past 4 weeks in Chiapas, Mexico, and the Reign of Terror. This is Richard Stoller Schulk.
One thing to note is the escalation of attacks against Zapatista communities. And one of the most recent examples of that is just about a week ago, the community of Moises Gandhi, a Zapatista support base community member, by the name of Lopez Santis, was shot. He's in critical condition. And in that case, it was a paramilitary group called Orcao, which often we've seen that the government and other nefarious forces use the paramilitaries as sort of their shock troops and to deny responsibility for the repression and trying to terrorize and drive out any kind of autonomous communities such as the Zapatistas and other indigenous groups. In that case, the victim of the attack is on life support. He's in critical condition, and the local hospital is claiming they don't have any space in their ICU for him. So that's kind of the lack of appreciation for human life and human rights. The victim is a Tzeltal indigenous man. So that's one kind of worrisome sign. There have been growing mobilizations and denunciations of the wave of attacks against Zapatista communities. It's really the model of autonomy that I think is threatening to the powers that be, because then the state and global capital can't control the land and the resources, much less the people on those territories. So they're bound and determined to try to crush autonomous models such as the Zapatistas.
Richard, how does this relate to other acts of violence related to indigenous peoples?
Well, there's definitely an increase of violence in Mexico. The AMLO, the López Obrador administration in Mexico, has really done very little to address the roots of the violence. In fact, all they're doing is kind of attacking the press whenever the media tries to cover it or draw attention to it. So they're trying to basically just silence it, but the violence is continuing to skyrocket. So, for example, in the last week, the growing conflicts between two of the major cartels, drug cartels, criminal organizations, the Sinaloa and the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartels, has broken out in open warfare along the Mexico-Guatemala border in the area around Frontera Camalapa. Entire towns have fled into the mountains. People are just, fleeing the violence. It's mostly indigenous people living in that area and who have been subjected to that. And a new paramilitary group in that region called Maíz, which appears to be linked to the Jalisco cartel, is doing a lot of the terrorizing. And it's not insignificant, I think, and this is kind of looking at the bigger picture, that the violence in that region is not only in a migration route from Central America, but also near the community of Chico Mucelo, where there is a Canadian-operated and owned mining operation owned by the Canadian Blackfire Exploration Company. And so the Chico Mucelo mine has been one of the focal points of clashes between indigenous communities defending land and territory and global capital like these Canadian mining companies. It was there in 2009 that indigenous activist Mariano Abarca was killed trying to defend the land and the territory and ancestral rights against the mining corporations and demand rights for the communities. So what appears to be a shootout between cartels often has other layers behind it. The criminal organizations sometimes clear an area, and then that is very advantageous for global capital because there's no organized resistance anymore. They've all been terrorized into submission.
And what about AMLO's administration? What's their hand in this situation?
Well, even though AMLO came into office claiming that he was against neoliberalism, that he was going to temper the forces of the global market with concern for indigenous communities, we're just not seeing it. He seems to have given a green light. In fact, he's a major champion of some of the most destructive of the investment mega projects, destructive in terms of the impact on indigenous communities and the impact on the environment. And just an example of this, just on the 18th of May, a couple of weeks ago, AMLO issued a presidential decree declaring that the major infrastructure projects that he's been promoting are national security matters, and therefore they can override any kind of environmental impact or other community rights that might slow down the advance of those devastating projects. And this is ironic because the Mexican Supreme Court actually overturned a similar decree that AMLO had passed in November of 2021, but he's at it again. The Supreme Court ruled in the last case that the decree violated the rights to transparency and access to information. So these mega projects, there are many, many of them, but three of the exemplary ones for the size and impact in Mexico are the so-called Mayan Train Project to connect a tourist route between the Palenque ruins in the state of Chiapas to the various Mayan sites in the Yucatan Peninsula. The Trans-Isthmian Corridor, which is a massive infrastructure and energy project in the state of Oaxaca across a narrow isthmus connecting Oaxaca and Chiapas, and the Morelos Integral Development Project, which includes gas pipelines and other major energy generating and other infrastructure. These projects are having a impact on indigenous people and the land. The Mexican Geography Institute, INEGI, recently issued a study showing that Mexico is the fourth most biodiverse country in the world. 12% of all the world's biodiversity is in Mexico. And, of course, indigenous people have been the ancestral guardians and caretakers of the land and the environment. So they're bearing the brunt of some of those mega projects. During the time of the AMLO administration, there are something like 1,600 of these projects, some of them of massive scale, like the three that I mentioned. A recent article in the business magazine Forbes said that 40% of the attacks on environmental defenders, violent attacks, were committed directly by the forces of the state. Another 39% were unidentified, meaning they're either the state or criminal organizations or transnational corporations. And frankly, sometimes those different violent operations are hard to distinguish from each other. And that same report that I mentioned by the Geography Institute showed that 39% of all the forests and 60% of the jungle territories in Mexico are in indigenous lands. The state of Oaxaca, for instance, where the Trans-Tasman Corridor is underway as one of these mega projects, has the number one largest percentage indigenous population in Mexico, and it's also the state that is the number one in number of violent attacks on environmental defenders. A major example there is an energy-generating hydroelectric dam, the Paso de la Reina Dam, where in early 2021, five environmental defenders were killed just in the first few months of the year in clashes over that mega project. So it goes on and on. What really is at the bottom of the growing violence and attacks on indigenous communities is the attempt to privately appropriate wealth from these communally held and really even kind of patrimony of humanity resources that are the land and the territory.
Richard, what is the reaction by indigenous peoples? What is CNI saying when it comes to this systemic violence? And also, you know, what about justice for indigenous peoples? There was a recent court decision on May 17th where five indigenous peoples were found guilty as land defenders. So, you know, speak to that, and you know, and what is this idea of justice in response to state, military, capitalistic violence perpetrated against indigenous peoples?
Sure, the judicial institutions are not providing much comfort for indigenous people and really for justice in Mexico. Sometimes there's some window dressing. Every once in a while, the courts will take some action, but then it's usually quietly rolled back. So the overall pattern, I would say, in looking at the application of justice in Mexico is impunity for the powerful. They literally get away with murder.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Richard Stoller-Schulk, providing us an update on the recent spike of state military cartel violence in Chiapas, Mexico. And now back to the interview.
And in a few cases, when there's enough, mostly international pressure, then there might be some arrests and even some convictions, but then usually the sentences are quietly rolled back and commuted. So that's kind of the pattern. Indigenous organizations, like you mentioned, the CNI, the National Indigenous Congress, have definitely been pushing back. So, for example, there's been a pattern of not only allowing the powerful to go free for their crimes, but also imprisoning the less powerful, who are political activists, on trumped-up charges. So the CNI has recently issued statements demanding the release of political prisoners, one of whom is a Zapatista support-based community member who's become the focal point of a lot of these campaigns to draw attention to the inadequacy of the judicial system, Manuel Gomez Vasquez. And then there are many other victims of the practice of forced disappearance, which if we go back to the old nasty dictatorships of the 1960s and 70s in South America, the Pinochet regime in Chile and so forth, that was a technique to simply make the inconvenient people vanish and never accept any responsibility for what happened to them. But communities are pushing back and they're saying, no, you know, until you present those people alive, we're considering the crime to be an ongoing crime and the state to be complicit until it effectively investigates and punishes the perpetrators. Another example of sort of the resistance and pushback is recently there was a caravan, a sort of investigative journey organized across southern Mexico by a number of indigenous groups. The project was called The South Resists, and the delegates, there were 940 participants in this caravan, traveled from late April through early May all across the south of Mexico and up into the Yucatan Peninsula, primarily heavily indigenous regions. They came from 40 different indigenous groups all over the world and represented 27 Mexican states and 30 countries. And they just issued a statement at the conclusion of that sort of investigative tour, demanding not only the release of the political prisoners, but also cancellation of some of the most destructive mega projects like the so-called Maya Train, which is not Mayan at all. It is imposed on Mayan people. And they've also, in their statement that just came out, the South Resist Caravan called for justice for the victims of femicide, another pattern of violence throughout Mexico, and they demanded an end to racist immigration policies. So, for example, the Mexican Immigration Institute refused to allow the daughter of Berta Cáceres, the Lenca indigenous Honduran woman, activist, environmental defender, they refused to allow her into the country, so she couldn't participate in the caravan, no particular reason other than that she was an indigenous activist and environmental defender. So all these things are being sort of gathered together, listed, and systematically denounced in an organized way with evidence collected by indigenous groups, such as this caravan of the South Resist. So people are definitely not taking all this lying down in the communities.
You touched on you know, migration through Mexico-Guatemala border there in Chiapas, and then you mentioned migration in response to this past question. I was wondering, how does that relate to the state violence under AMLO's administration with the recent Biden administration's ending of Title 42?
Yes, migration has definitely been a focal point of a lot of violence. The migrants have been victimized by everyone from the state to the criminal organizations all along the path. Desperate people who are fleeing one form of violence in their homelands, often in Central America, but many are fleeing from violence in parts of Mexico as well and other parts of the world. So they're fleeing that violence, and then they are the targets of violence, of predatory violence, especially kidnapping and extortion, all along the route, trying to get to the northern U.S. border. Well, first of all, on the southern Mexican border, the U.S. has kind of exported its anti-immigrant repression to Mexico by pressuring the government of Mexico to be a kind of first line of a wall of sorts, a figurative wall at the Mexico-Guatemala border. So going back a few years, the U.S. and Mexico signed an agreement called the Southern Border Plan, in which Mexico agreed to stop Central American migrants at the southern border. And, well, that's precisely where this flare-up of violence is occurring, in the Frontera Comalapa, the region on the Mexican-Guatemalan border. The AMLO administration created a new militarized force called the National Guard, which never existed in Mexico before. And even though during his campaign he promised that it would not be subject to control of the military, he immediately did the opposite and appointed an active duty general to head the National Guard, and has heavily militarized. Many of those new National Guard militarized forces have been sent to the southern Mexican border, ostensibly as part of a so-called war on drugs, but we see that they're nowhere to be found when these shootouts are occurring between the cartels. So they're definitely not interested in controlling the criminal violence, but they do seem to always show up in and around Zapatista communities and other autonomous communities to intimidate and terrorize. So militarization on the borders, whether it's the southern Mexican border or the U.S.-Mexican border, is just throwing fuel on the fire. and adding to the vast numbers of deaths, making people even more vulnerable on the migratory path. So when the Biden administration went back to the Trump era policies, well, first they tried to invoke this thinly veiled health pretext for violating international law and excluding asylum seekers, flagrant violation of the international requirement to give people the opportunity to seek political asylum. And then when Title 42, this public health provision of U.S. law expired, now the Biden administration is simply finding other pretexts and methods of expelling and excluding migrants, many of whom are dumped across the border in some of the most dangerous and violent areas on the U.S.-Mexican border, where, once again, they're preyed on by all of these organized criminal organizations. So it's a terrible situation in which the governments of the U.S. and Mexico are both kind of complicit, at best looking the other way, and creating the conditions for this violence, all of the while that they're claiming that they're dealing with supposedly issues of national security or reducing the flow of drugs.
Richard, when I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of not only the militarization of the border along the colonial nation states of Mexico and Guatemala, but I think of indigenous peoples whose traditional and or treaty homelands are separated by these colonial borders, whether it be, for example, the Mohawks in the northeastern part of the states, whose traditional homelands also include, you know, Canada along with the U.S., and then here in the U.S., like Lipan Apaches in Texas and Mexico, the Kumeyaay people, right? All these colonial borders have been militarized that make it difficult for the indigenous peoples in these respective areas. So how does that affect indigenous peoples along the imposed colonial borders of Mexico and Guatemala?
Sure. These borders didn't exist before they were imposed forcibly by the violent exercise of settler colonialism. In the tradition of indigenous peoples throughout the Americas, Guna indigenous word for the Western Hemisphere is Abya-Yala. The conception is that these are one land, one unified landmass from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, where people live, and people live in harmony with the environment. And governments came along and divided people and drew lines and passed laws criminalizing people on the wrong side of these artificial laws that they created and used that as an excuse to take their resources and oppress them. Specifically on the U.S.-Mexican border, as you pointed out, there are several native groups that have historically lived on both sides of what later became the imposed border, the Tohono O'odham, the Yaqui people, others, and they're very much affected by some of these mega projects. The Yaqui people, for instance, have been affected by an aqueduct that was built to divert water from the Yaqui River and send it off to industrial parts of northern Mexico, and it's a desert territory. If you don't have water, you don't have life, and that's, of course, to varying degrees true everywhere, water as the basis for life. So these are very different visions of, the term development, as it's used by these capitalist enterprises, doesn't take into account the collective interest in preserving the land and the environment, the cultural interest and rights of communities. Just to take an example, the Maya Train Project, one of these mega projects promoted by AMLO, it's one of the most destructive of the mega projects. Some studies have recently shown that there are over 6,000 underground caves filled with water called cenotes in that region in the path of the train that are at risk of collapse and devastation if the train project goes through to conclusion. Those cenotes are ancestral sites where the Mayan people have performed religious and spiritual rituals. It's very important for the culture of the peoples of that territory, so that many Mayan activists in the Yucatan Peninsula have referred to this as cultural genocide.
Sorry, I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late, everything here is great, but we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills. Some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory,